Hi and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year police career in the UK. Hopefully you found it interesting so far. If you've been listening before, this is episode 68. So we've done a few. And if this is your first time, welcome. But you might want to go back to the beginning to start it off, you know, in order. But entirely up to you. Thanks very much for the downloads again. Fantastic. And some YouTube comments. And even better, selfishly, some more coffees bought for me on the Buy Me a Coffee app. So thank you. I'll be all coffeed out for sure. So we're going to continue on. One thing I was going to ask, and I don't know if it would interest many people out there. I'm aware that some people that listen, as a few of you have messaged me before, that you're either considering joining the UK police or have just joined, perhaps. So you're listening and perhaps getting a little insight to a taste of what you might have coming. I was thinking about doing an episode purely on police recruitment and perhaps some of the stages. Now, a little bit might be out of date, but certainly the process, normally you get invited along to do, you know, a day or two of tests and things. I've done that kind of three separate times, you know, when I've transferred forces and initially joining myself. That I know isn't out of date. So I could do an episode sort of purely on the recruitment process. Perhaps pop some comments on the YouTube channel if you know, if that would be of any interest. I might well do that. So today we're going to talk about something different. Now, I have to say I've been going through some of my the incidents I've got recorded. And the way I've done this, I think I mentioned this before, but not for a long time. So I'll just mention it again. Basically, fairly early on in my career, probably within the first 5 years or so of 28 and a half years, on the notes in your phone, every now and then when I went to an incident of note or something that perhaps I thought was, you know, particularly, you know, interesting in one way or another, whether it was horrendously gory or gruesome, because I'm afraid a lot of us, as we know, are fairly have, you know, morbid fascination and like that sort of stuff, or funny or whatever it was. I just made literally a one or two line note of the incident so that I wouldn't forget it. Not really thinking, I mean, podcasts weren't even a thing then, but just thinking in the future, maybe I might, you know, write a book or something about my career, which is still potentially on the cards. And that carried on throughout my career. So when I got to the end of my career and I look back, I think there was something like 110, something like that, different sort of incidents I had of note. Now, over that period of time, obviously, I'd done, you know, a lot more jobs, but a lot of them are very mundane, very run-of-the-mill. So perhaps apart from the early chapters when I wanted to sort of set the scene of the podcast, you know, I haven't talked about lots of incidents, but the ones of note I have, and it doesn't mean there's going to be like 115 episodes, because a lot of them I've either ruled out for various reasons, or sometimes, you know, two or three of those incidents have been absorbed into one podcast episode, you know, so we'll see how we go. But I think they'll probably end up being something like 80, 85 episodes in total, and we'll see. You know, as I say, I'm not 100% sure, because sometimes they end up being a lot longer than I think, because as you probably figured out already, I can blar on quite a bit, and what I think is quite a short incident, when I get into it and then run off on a tangent like you do, it ends up taking up a whole episode. So let me know anyway if it's working for you, and if you think it's too long, it's too short, it could be longer, etc. Again, probably YouTube on some comments there might help. Anyway, today, and the other thing I realised when I look back at those is that I've probably got these, because I didn't put dates at all, so I had a look on the internet, and some of these might be a little bit out of sync with each other. You know, I may have talked about some incidents before others, you know, so in terms of history, they're possibly slightly out of order of how I dealt with them, but it doesn't really matter, so just so you're aware. Okay, so today we're going to talk about an incident that happened November 2013. I was still on the dive team and the underwater and confined spaces team, to give it its full title. And we had a job that came in on in the county of Surrey in England, which is right on the edge of the Met ground. And every now and then, the sort of the ground that the Metropolitan Police cover, you know, the geography of it changes slightly, perhaps as council areas changes and things. So over the years, Surrey, which is right on the edge of the Met, At times, part of it's have been the Met and other parts Surrey Police, and then vice versa. So officers that work there, if they want to remain in the same place, quite often find themselves deciding that they're going to transfer to the Met to stay in their same role, in their same nick, in their same police station, you know, or likewise, you know, if they're in the Met, they can transfer out to Surrey to stay at that same place. So there's a bit of movement. But anyway, this incident happened in a place called Wallingham, which is right on the border and at the time was in the Met area. So we covered it. And what happened was a very nice house, quite a big house, a big detached sort of country house, really, in a really nice area of Surrey, which is a very sort of well-to-do place in the south of England. It's near to Gatwick Airport, near to London, so has all those good links. And equally, you know, the house prices are absolutely, you know, huge there, certainly for the UK. So, yeah, really expensive place to live. And this incident came in. There was a house there, and I assume they'd split up a lot of the bedrooms. And it was obviously quite a large property, as I said. But there was, at one point, there was 8 Polish guys living, all sharing this same house. And over the years, neighbours had reported various issues there. I think it was sort of drinking and fighting, which was very, you know, shocking for the area because, you know, we don't do that sort of thing around here. But so there'd been a few issues at the house. Nothing terrible, I don't think. But certainly perhaps not what the area was used to. But November 2013, I presume the owner had some gardeners in that were looking after the property. It had quite extensive sort of grounds and gardens. So it's not the sort of thing, you know, you run a lawnmower around for 10 minutes and that's you done. There was lots of things going on there. So I assume they had gardeners come in every now and then and do some work. And they had a well in the garden. Not that big a well, probably only 3 or 4 feet across. I think it was about 11 feet deep, and the actual water level in it was 4 feet deep within the well. And it was covered, you know, had a grill on it and had, you know, it's like a slab across it to make sure that, you know, no one could fall in or anything. But I think generally it got used as a bit of a rubbish, you know, bin, which it obviously shouldn't have. So it ended up with quite a bit of rubbish in it. But yeah, around about this time, these two gardeners were asked to go into the well to clear it out because it had so much rubbish in it. So they got into this well, and I don't actually know how they did it. Whether they put ladders in, whether they used ropes, I'm not quite sure. They're quite young, these guys. I think one was 17, one was 21. So they were only, you know, pretty much teenagers thereabouts. And they entered the well, and one thing they found in the bottom, apart from all the rubbish, was something wrapped in tarpaulin, which they didn't particularly realize what it was, and it was getting in their way, so they kept sort of pushing it aside. It was only when they looked a bit closer that they realized they were probably looking at a body or parts of a body. So they were fairly shocked, to say the least, and I should imagine they came out of that well quite quickly. But obviously the police were called, and because of the difficulty in the location and quite where it was, you know, your average searcher wasn't really set up to get that through all sorts of reasons, a lot of them being, you know, health and safety. So they called us in. Perfect job for us because it's a confined space. It could be a dive because no one knew at that point how deep the well was, you know. So there's all sorts of issues, but they're pretty much all covered by my team at the time. So we were called along to this job. And I think the first day typically was a weekend. So it was a call out. I think I've told you before that team at that time only worked Monday to Friday. And it was a call out basis on the weekend. So this was a weekend. We were called out of our, it wasn't our beds because it was during the day. So we came out. We did dive at night, you know, but generally things were left to the next day. It was very rare. Remember that we were a recovery sort of service, not a rescue service. So whatever it was in the water, whether it was a weapon or a body, it was still going to be there in the morning. So generally we only worked in the day. But the occasions when we did work in the night and in the dark, and in fact, my first body recovery, if you listen back a good few chapters now, a good few episodes, you'll hear about that one. That was in the dark. And people at the time were like, wow, it must be so much more difficult diving in the dark. And the reality is, don't forget that every bit of diving, virtually every bit of diving that I ever did, you know, on that unit was in the dark, in the water, you know. So the daylight obviously makes life easier to work on the bank. And the only issues it really causes working at night was for the people on the bank, you know, that have to set up the kit. You need to make sure you get some lighting. But once you're in the water, it's always pitch black, you know, night or day, it doesn't matter. So it makes very little difference. Anyway, there's one of those tangents I was talking about. Back to the story. excuse me. So these guys found what they believed to be a body into the well, and we came out, and fairly quickly the HAT team, the homicide action team, was stood up, because it looked very much like it was probably going to be a murder. So, and even if it wasn't, those guys would come out initially to assess that, but also to make sure that everything was put in place should it become a murder inquiry. Because what you don't want to do is, you know, go, oh, it's just a body, we don't know if it's a murder yet, you don't need to call the murder team, we just leave it, you know. And then various cops, maybe including myself, go in, you know, bungling around and stomping all over a scene, recover a body, only to then discover it's a murder, and by that time you may well have ruined all the evidence because you weren't, you know, following the sort of protocols had it been a murder. So quite often, if a body was found, unless it was a very obvious or seemingly very obvious one, perhaps, you know, an elderly person that had cancer or something had passed away, so very much expected in a private house, you know, you wouldn't have a murder team out for that. But other things that were a little bit edgy, and this obviously was, certainly with the body being found in the well, the HAT team would come out and you'd sort of treat it as a murder to start with until you knew otherwise, and that way we didn't get caught out. So they came out, various forensic teams come out, but they couldn't do anything until we'd recovered the body. So that was our first challenge, and it was quite a difficult one. Now, we had I think I showed a photo a few episodes back, but we had a crane system, like on a tripod, that we set up over top of the well. And we put the diver in full dive kit because, again, we didn't know how deep it was. We tried to sort of plumb the depths using, you know, weight on a piece of string. But we didn't know for sure, were we hitting the bottom, which suggested it was about 4 foot deep, which we now know it was, or were we hitting debris, you know, or the body itself, and couldn't get past it perhaps, and therefore it could have been 20 feet deep. So to play it safe, we put the diver in as that, you know, in full dive kit. He was lowered into the well and confirmed that, you know, he could stand up, and it came to kind of, you know, just over his waist, sort of sometimes maybe mid-chest height, you know, something like that, around about 4 foot of water. So we realised at that point it wasn't a dive, although it was, as you can imagine, really unpleasant. We subsequently discovered that the body had been in there 2 years. So if you can imagine a mix of well water that probably didn't have a lot of fresh water coming into it, now has had a body in it for 2 years, through the seasons, through the 30 degree summer heat, through the, you know, minus whatever cold in the winter, and on top of that a lot of rubbish has been thrown in as well, what you get unfortunately is a kind of mix of, you know, unfortunately body soup. You know, you can't really call it anything else. So very, very unpleasant conditions. So a lot of the time they stayed in full dive kit because that gave them a full face mask, you know, that couldn't be you weren't getting the smells and the unpleasantness through. So we set about trying to recover this body. Now, it was wrapped in tarpaulin, but most of that tarpaulin had sort of come off. The intention was to bring him out. We assumed it was a him, although that wasn't actually clear because of the state of decomposition. We wanted to bring him out, you know, with as much of the tarpaulin intact as well, because obviously there'd be a lot of evidence within that tarpaulin. But of course, what that did was meant a lot of the liquid came out with him as well. So a body alone is obviously a very heavy item. You know, people talk about dead weights, and if you've ever tried to move dead weights, you know, you'll know that, yeah, potentially a body is very, very heavy. If you then add in all that liquid trapped in the tarpaulin, you know, you've got a very, very heavy item. So initially we tried to lift it like that, with sort of a winch that was attached to our tripod. Proved quite difficult, not impossible. And even more unpleasant was the poor old diver who was at the bottom had a lot of the contents of that tarpaulin leaking out on top of him. So at that point he was glad that he'd stayed in his full dive kit. So he was effectively, you know, he had a barrier of a dry suit and a full face mask, you know, and gloves and stuff on, so he wasn't actually getting the liquid next to his skin, but still pretty unpleasant of bits falling out. And we were very aware that things were falling out, potential evidence back into the well, but because it was pretty much sealed, we knew we'd have to then go through and search that well properly after he'd finished. So we managed to eventually raise the body up, still in its tarpaulin. As I say, a lot of the water had drained out. A particularly difficult and unpleasant task, and the male, we now knew it was a male, was recovered. So we had to get our thinking caps on. How are we going to ensure that we've not lost any evidence in the bottom of this well? And certainly, if you remember to, I think it was last episode, Grenfell Tower, we talked about riddles, which is like big sieves, but with bigger sort of mesh to allow things to drop through. It was decided perhaps we could use those, but basically the 4 foot of water in that well was going to have to come out bucket by bucket to then be sieved through. So we set up a sort of workstation effectively, and I was chosen to be the riddler, if that's the thing. And we had a couple of tables set out. We had a small stool. I had some tarpaulin laid out, and I was sat on my stool with my riddle in hand, and the guys basically winched up bucket after bucket of what was effectively sludge stroke body soup. Now, I had no sort of face protection, if you like. You know, I didn't have a full face mask or anything. I was just sat there in a dry suit with gloves on, going through this stuff on my little stool with my riddle. And they would bring out a bucket, and then one of the guys would sort of dollop out, and it was a dollop, unfortunately, dollop out, gunge into my riddle. And I would sieve through it and use a bit of water to sort of sieve through it and wash through it. And I was looking for anything of interest and importance. And in fact, the guys had done this before, some years before, at a sewage farm where they believed that a woman had been murdered by her husband, who worked at that sort of wastewater factory. And then he'd put her through the system in there, which is a series of sort of machines that chop things up and filter stuff out, and eventually you end up with clean water at the end. They did exactly this same process there and had some real success with it. Ended up recovering some of her fingers and her wedding rings, which was enough to convict the guy of her murder at the time. So they knew this worked, and this is what we were hoping for in this occasion. And it took a while. I mean, you can imagine 4 foot of water, you know, sort of 3 foot across, 4 foot deep. I'm sure somebody can work that out, but it's a lot of water. It's a lot of buckets of water, and buckets after buckets came up that I riddled through. And some items were picked out of use, possibly anyway. And we had the forensic guys standing beside me, and they were kind of saying, right, we'll keep that as an exhibit. We want to look at that as evidence, you know, and some of the things came out. But this went on for several days. You know, I think I was there probably 3 days in total. Not straight, obviously. I went home at night, you know, and then came back. But kind of three 8-hour days of riddling through this muck, you know, very unpleasant. And you can imagine the smells were pretty horrendous. But ultimately, we managed to recover a few things. And of the now 7 guys that lived in the house, all 7 of them were arrested, because obviously it wasn't clear what role, if any, they played in this, what we now believe to be a murder. It was being treated as a murder at this point. We'd had a Home Office pathologist come in who'd had a kind of quick look at the body. Obviously, there was a post-mortem to be carried out to establish a cause of death. But initially, he said there does appear to be signs of an assault to start with, which is why it became a murder. So, yeah, the 7 guys from the house were arrested, and they were off being interviewed, trying to establish what happened. I mean, ultimately, the post-mortem happened, and a further, I think, 3 Polish guys that were linked to that address were also arrested. There's certainly some talk of arguments and fights, and we knew that from previous police calls, that there had been some issues around drink at that location, you know, people getting drunk, fighting, etc. They were working on the theory at that point, I think, that it was one of these occasions that had perhaps spilled over and got carried away, you know, rather than just being pushing and shoving fisticuffs. It had gone on that far that he'd been so badly assaulted that ultimately he died, and then his body had been wrapped in tarpaulin and dropped into the well. And I think that's a pretty good guess at what happened, because unfortunately they carried out the post-mortem and it wasn't conclusive. You can imagine a body that's been in the conditions I've described for 2 years, very difficult even for an expert to establish how they died. all the usual ways they would use were sort of taken off them in terms of forensics and also looking at internal organs and things, because a lot of that stuff has kind of putrefied and has turned liquidy at that point anyway. So it's very difficult to measure and actually to get anything out. But they definitely 100% knew he'd been subject to an assault prior to going in there. And yeah, the theory was probably died of a head injury or something, but they could never establish how he died. Yeah, 7 were arrested from the house, a further 3 that were linked, and they were all interviewed. But unfortunately, there were no charges brought in the end. We just couldn't prove who did what. You know, the evidence was too far gone at that point. Much like on a lesser scale, if I was to stop a car with 4 lads in, say, and we found some cocaine in the car, you'd be saying to them, whose is this? You know, and invariably you're hit with a wall of silence. So certainly in that scenario, you'd keep asking them, and eventually, if no one was going to sort of fess up that it was theirs, you'd have to put it to them, well, until I have interviewed all of you, I don't know whose it is. So to investigate it, all 4 of you are getting arrested. And then, you know, series of interviews, we will establish whose it is, or we'll try and establish. Normally at that point, one of them would go, all right, it's mine, you know, don't arrest the other 3, it's just, you know, just take me sort of thing. But much the same with the body, obviously, we didn't know the involvement. We knew that 7 lived there, which is why they came in. And because don't forget, certainly in England, you know, you arrest on suspicion of whatever it is, whether it's common assault or murder, there's a suspicion. You need some evidence to point towards them, not enough that it's going to go to court, because what you're now trying to establish is that evidence to take it to court for a charge. But initially, if you have a reasonable suspicion someone has assaulted someone, for example, no matter what the level, common assault, the very lowest level, murder, the highest level, then you have the power to arrest them in England and Wales as a police officer. So they would be taken away, and then you do your investigation, which involves obviously interviewing, looking at CCTV, house-to-house inquiries, speaking to witnesses, you know, all the things you do, forensics, all those things to try and get enough evidence to then take it forward and convict them. Once you've got all that evidence together, certainly in England, Wales now, you go to the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, and you say to them, I have this guy in custody, this is all the evidence I've got, what do you think? They're the ones that make the decision, give you a charging decision as to whether release NFA, no further action, or yes, charge with ABH, actual bodily harm, and put them to the courts. We think there is a realistic chance of conviction, and we're willing to run that court case and try to convict that person for that offence. And then you would go on down back into custody where they're waiting in the cells. They get formally charged, released, and told you must come to court, you know, on this date, which will probably be, you know, sort of 3 or 6 months in the future. And that's their trial, and that's kind of how it works in England and Wales. It's slightly different in Scotland, and we'll talk about that in future chapters because there are a few differences. So we never established what happened there. But talking of Scotland, we'll bring that in now, because privately at this point, I decided personally that I was going to move to Scotland. There are various personal reasons which I won't go into, but I had recently been to Greenock, which is on the west coast of Scotland, and done my 2-week dive refresher. Remember, we talked about you were commercial divers, and every 5 years you had to do a 2-week refresher. I'd been to Greenock, and I'd had 2 weeks diving up and around in Scotland, and absolutely loved it. Loved the place. Not really been to Scotland that much at that point, only as a kid, you know, on family holidays, but when I was very young, so I don't really remember it. But had a, you know, the guys at Scotland, the police divers in Scotland were fantastic, gave us a really good tour of the area, and we did quite a bit of diving over 2 weeks. And yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it, but absolutely fell in love with the place, and happened to mention it to my wife and jokingly said, you know, we should move to Scotland, of which she replied, you know, sure, okay, you know. So ultimately, that's what we did. You know, we sold everything up, we up sticks, and we moved up to Scotland, the west coast of Scotland. Now, you might be asking, well, how do you do that? You were working in London. But at the time, the flights were very, very cheap. You could get Ryanair flights. For one way, I could get flights for, you know, literally £15 or £20 if I timed it right, for an hour's flight from Glasgow to London. There was about 4 different companies operating the route out of Glasgow. They went into 4 or 5 different airports down south that had various sort of good train connections straight into central London. And what I actually did and what I intended to do was fly down on a Sunday night and then stay the week in London. I had the option of staying in London during the week, effectively crashing on a floor or on a camp bed. And that's what I did. And then Friday when I finished work, or Thursday when I finished work, I would then fly home, have the weekend at home, and then fly back. Now, to some of you, that will sound crazy. And if it went perfectly, it was a 5-hour commute from stepping out of my front door at home in Scotland to arriving, you know, at the office at work was 5 hours. But that's if the commute went perfectly. It never did. You know, invariably, there was always delayed flights, you know, late trains, cancelled flights. And the worst case scenario was getting in very late on the last flight in and having worked out that I just got time to run to the last train into London from Southend or one of the sort of more remote airports to find that, you know, the flight was delayed half an hour. So I missed it. And then I then had to sleep in the airport overnight, you know, perched in a chair. On one occasion, they turned the heating off. I think it was Southend. I was freezing. It was in the winter. And I ended up going into the area where there was the fruit machines. And I slept in the arcadey bit by the fruit machine, sort of wrapped around a fruit machine for warmth until the first train out in the morning, which was kind of 5 or 6 in the morning. But initially, naively, I thought it was doable. And I only had to do it for 3 years. And then I could retire early. That was the plan. That was the thinking at that point. Well, I'll let you know how that went in the future episodes. I'll leave you hanging on that one. But it did and it didn't work. And we'll talk about that. And I've dropped that in because it has an effect. It had an effect on the work from the diving point of view. I'm not entirely sure my bosses were happy with it because it was a little bit restrictive. We've talked about the bends before. And anybody that knows anything about diving will perhaps be aware that you can fly before diving, no problems at all. What you shouldn't do and what you can't do is dive and then fly, because you're putting yourself at huge altitude. Even in commercial airlines that have pressurized cabins, you're still considerably higher than ground level. If you had any residual bubbles in your system, nitrogen bubbles in your system from diving, when you're taken to height, they will expand and potentially cause you the bends. So it's a big, big no-no. You never, ever fly after diving. Otherwise, you could get the bends. So really, you have to leave it at least 24 hours after diving to fly. So what that meant was when I was diving during the week, most of our diving was pretty shallow canals and stuff, you know, 2 and 3 meters, maybe the odd dock, you know, that was 10 meters. But to be safe, towards the end of the week, I didn't ever dive, you know, kind of Thursday, I wouldn't dive. I would make sure that I was either a supervisor when I'd done the supervisor's course, or I was always an attendant, or I was the driver, or I was doing something else, not actually diving on that Thursday, to allow that safety buffer of 24 hours prior to flying home on the Friday night. It worked okay. It was a bit restrictive. I don't think the guys on the team worried too much. It didn't really affect anything. And again, I think the bosses perhaps initially were sceptical, but actually, I think we made it work in the end. But there we go. That's probably about it for this week. Bit of a mishmash this week. There was a job in there somewhere. There was a certain amount of ramblings and just telling you kind of how things were. And yeah, various tangents, as we quite often have. Hopefully you're still enjoying it. Keep coming back if you want to, or don't. It's up to you. Okay then, take it easy. Have a good week. Speak to you soon. Cheers. Bye.